Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. For the first time in more than 15 years, Suffolk County voters will choose a new district attorney this election because longtime DA Dan Conley has stepped down. The choice in next month's election is between Democrat Rachel Rollins and independent candidate Michael Maloney. We will talk with Rachel Rollins in just a few minutes, but first we're joined in studio by Michael Maloney. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Deborah, good afternoon. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, thanks for coming in. You and your opponent are considered fairly progressive in terms of district attorney candidates. What do you think are the big differences?
Well, you're right. We certainly are running on progressive platforms. Me, myself, I've been practicing criminal law as a defense attorney for a decade now. Some of the big differences, though, again, I'm not going to leave my experience as a defense attorney behind. I certainly value treatment over incarceration, truly, for nonviolent addicts. But some places that we truly differentiate, I take a very hard line on gun violence. I support minimum mandatories for gun charges. There have been way too many violent crimes. Homicides are up. Going big picture here, Deborah, in regards to the method and the mechanisms by which my opponents and I are looking to incorporate reform, that's really the big differentiating variable here. I'm talking about progressive reform, not necessarily issuing blanket statements saying we're not going to prosecute, but alternatively looking at incorporating reform based on a revised cash bail system, adjustments in regards to minimum mandatories associated with addicts, and working with law enforcement, not necessarily against law enforcement, to ensure the safety of the public at large.
So I think in some regards, you're referring to a list that was published by Rachel Rollins, this sort of do not prosecute list of 15 crimes that she said that she wouldn't prosecute. I want to play a little bit of tape here from her and have you react to it, because I think this sort of explains a little bit more here about what's going on. And she said that the reason that she came up with this list of crimes that she wouldn't prosecute for things like drug possession and resisting arrest is because she thinks the resources should go elsewhere. Let's listen.
We have a 67% recidivism rate, guys, for some of these crimes. And what I'm doing is proposing a potential solution where we just do a quality control check on these 15 and see pre-arraignment whether these individuals need diversion, whether they need treatment instead of incarceration. And why I did this, the most important thing of all of this, I want to focus our attention on violent serious crimes.
So Michael Maloney, it still sounds a little similar to me in terms of what you're saying. I mean, she is saying treatment, not incarceration, but she does have this list of crimes that she doesn't want to prosecute automatically. So where is the big difference here?
The difference is not necessarily in the intentions that my opponent and I are looking to incorporate. It's really in the mechanism by which we're looking to incorporate. So, for example, rather than not prosecute, I take, people need to be held accountable. If individuals are not held accountable, then unfortunately, crime is going to increase. That's inevitable. You want to talk about my path to progressive, responsible reform? Well, I'm talking about bail reform, the cash bail system. For example, no longer requesting bail on individuals, which my administration will not be seeking a jail sentence. I'd say that sounds like a pretty common sense, but unfortunately, I can tell you as a defense attorney, I have seen hundreds and hundreds of individuals held on $100 bail where the prosecution actually never intended to seek a jail sentence. Not only is it the wrong thing to do, but, financially, it is simply inefficient. Now, I do agree that responsible reform needs to be incorporated. We should not be prosecuting conditions of poverty, conditions of mental health, conditions of addiction. Again, I do favor treatment, but the mechanism by which I'm incorporating varies tremendously. I can tell you another differentiating point right here. I do not support increasing the juvenile age, which is what my opponent does. That just allows an opportunity to become hardened while they're in the system. I do support, however, increasing diversionary programs from the age of 18 to 25.
Okay, so your opponent has suggested that she supports, we haven't talked with her directly yet, but that she supports increasing the age of adult criminal responsibility from the age of 18, where it is now in Massachusetts, to the age of 21. You don't support that, but instead you would say use diversion programs instead?
That is correct.
Okay.
And again, the overarching objective here, I've been a defense attorney. Again, I'm not going to leave that experience. I want to keep people out of the system whenever possible. But to kick the can down the road and to arbitrarily suggest that increasing juvenile, the age where an individual is legally responsible as an adult from 18 to 21, you know, that is not going to rectify the issue. What that's going to do is take a 16, 17-year-old kid that's on the verge, the cusp of making going the right path or the wrong path, and it's going to allow them to continue being hardened because they are not held accountable.
Well, some might say put an 18-year-old in jail, and that will definitely seal that 18-year-old's fate of being hardened.
Oh, I certainly would agree. And again, I'm advocating for treatment over incarceration for nonviolent addicts. I would agree with that position.
But if someone were that age and got in trouble now, wouldn't that typically be the way it went? You know, maybe they wouldn't go to an adult jail, but they might go to a diversion program?
Well, actually, diversionary programs, I'm licensed in 4 states. I've been practicing all over this state for a very long time. I can tell you that diversionary programs in Suffolk County are now only afforded in the juvenile system. That's not the same as other counties within Massachusetts. Again, I'm not looking to reinvent the wheel across the board. I'm picking and selecting ideas and theories that have worked in other counties and in other states. And diversionary programs are one, you know, component that we can incorporate on day one, which is exactly what I'll do.
Let's move on a little bit because we're going to run out of time here. This position involves managing hundreds of employees. There's a $20 million budget in the district attorney's office. What do you think in your background qualifies you for this?
Well, thank you for the question. I appreciate it. In addition to practicing criminal law and building a very successful practice with offices both in Boston and Brockton, I have been a serial entrepreneur for probably close to 15 years. I have built, managed, and sold many companies in the Commonwealth. And I can tell you that just in that December of 2017, I sold my most recent company, Canacare Docs, which was a medical marijuana evaluation facility. When I sold that company with my partner, we had employed, at that point, 182 employees over 7 states. You know, I can tell you that the company has continued to grow. And I don't say that to boast whatsoever, but this position is truly a combination of having criminal law experience and managerial experience. And when you want to talk about managerial experience, I'm happy to do it all day long, but I would also respectfully request you look at legal experience. I have handled misdemeanors through life sentence felony cases across the state for a very long time. In fact, I had to take 3 weeks off from campaigning in April to manage a Superior Court felony case in Fall, not to manage, to try a Superior Court felony case in Fall River Superior. My opponent has not actually ever had a jury trial. My opponent has not actually argued motions or been in the criminal law system at the state level. And when you're talking about managerial experience, again, let's have that conversation all day long, but let's not pretend you can be in a position to manage several hundred employees, attorneys, when you've never actually practiced in this industry.
The Boston Globe earlier this month reported on a restraining order that your wife had sought against you. And in that restraining order, she said that 3 times between 2013 and 2014, you were intoxicated, threatening, and violent, saying that you threatened her, threatened to cut her father, put holes in the wall with a hammer. Now you have addressed this a bit, and you've said it was a low point in your life. But first, I want to make clear, do you take any issue with those things as alleged in that request for a restraining
I can say
order?
That I spoke with my former wife most recently, actually today. We have an amicable relationship. I am not proud of the decisions that I made verbally when I was going through a divorce. It was, when you say a low point, that's not accurate. It was the lowest point in my life. I was absolutely heartbroken, and I wish I could take back things I said and things I did. But, you know, my experience has been as a defense attorney that people should not be judged at the lowest point in their life. Rather, you should look at the individual as a whole. I can tell you that my former wife supports me. She has said she is publicly available to speak with the media. I speak with her, I don't want to say routinely, but we have each other's respect. We have each other's respect, and we have developed an amicable, respectful relationship. You know, again, I made mistakes in the past. I would ask people to judge me by the entirety of my person rather than an isolated incident during the lowest point of my life from 5 years ago.
So you don't think, I mean, what about voters who might say, I think this raises questions about your temperament overall?
Well, you know, again, that's a very valid question, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address it. But in regards to, you know, my temperament, I didn't come into this campaign having any false expectations that my past would not, you know, come to light. I've been very candid about where I've come from. I've been very candid about my background. I am an open book.
Do you think you should have been more forthcoming about this first, about this restraining order issue? Because it became, it didn't come out really until the Globe.
You know, I certainly try to be. I, as an independent, you're right. I mean, I should have been more proactive about addressing it. But I got to tell you, running as an independent is really difficult. I showed up to not just one, not just two, not just three, but many debates during the primary. And then was told at the door, you have to leave because you're not a registered Democrat. Again, I'm an independent. I don't have the support of either party platform. I am out there hustling day in, day out, each and every night. In hindsight, yes, I should have been more proactive and figured out a way to make it abundantly clear. I'm not hiding from my past. I'm not hiding from mistakes. I am a flawed individual. I have made mistakes. And when I was heartbroken, oh man, I wish I could take it back. But that's who I am. I'm asking voters to look at me in the entirety. Look at my positions. Look at what I've done over 10 years. Look at how I've afforded individuals. Former clients, you know, took care of their case. Represented them pro bono and then offered them employment on the flip side. I have been advocating for second chances my whole life, and you know, I'm asking for the same in this situation.
So when you're talking about reform, it's a professional passion for you as well as one that's personally informed.
Oh, I got involved into this industry, like I said, about 10 years ago. Some of the highest points in my career have been individuals that have come back to me after I've represented them. You know, they may have started off as clients, but they've become friends. And they've reached out to me. They've asked me how I am. I have relationships with their family. Yes, it is absolutely a professional career, but I tell you, it bleeds over into the private sector constantly.
I just want to touch on one issue before we run out of time, and that's something that's been in the news this week when the state Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz talked about these controversies that we're hearing about judges in Massachusetts and whether judges should be removed because of controversial rulings. Do we now have enough oversight of judges in Massachusetts, and should that system change? And I'm sorry that you have a minute to answer.
I tell you, that's a topic that we could spend a long time talking about.
Yeah.
There is not enough oversight of judges, and there certainly should be.
Should some be removed?
Listen, there are some judges. I can, and again, I've practiced in every county across the state, with the one exception being Nantucket. I can tell you that the way cases are dealt with varies tremendously based on the individual on the bench. Mm-hmm. You know, agree or disagree with the judge's position, it should always be respectful. It should always be respectful. The overwhelming majority of the time, that is the case. But I can tell you, I've witnessed it firsthand where that is simply not what happens. There should be more oversight.
All right. Michael Maloney, independent candidate for Suffolk County District Attorney. Thanks for coming in.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear from the Democratic candidate for Suffolk County DA, Rachel Rollins. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.